Should I leave the mic on? No. This is the House State Affairs Committee meeting. Today is Wednesday, February 20th, 1991. Time is 8:37. Members present are myself, Representative Cabina, Representative Moyer, Representative Choquette, Representative Baker. Today we have on the agenda House Bill 129 relating to the Public Officers Compensation Committee Commission, House Bill 126 relating to program receipts cleanup, further consideration of House Bill 4 relating to legislative ethics. I'd like to please make sure if anybody would like to testify that they have signed up on the sheet. First thing we're going to hear today is House Bill 126. House Bill 126 is an act making technical amendments to program receipts revisions in Alaska statutes as recommended by the revisor of statutes in order to conform the statutes to Chapter 36, FSLA 1990, and providing for effective date. This morning we have Dave Deerdorf, the revisor of statutes here. Mr. Deerdorf, would you take the hot seat, please, and good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We just got a fiscal note in on this one anyways, and it is at zero. Dave, just continue how you think best.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm David Deerdorf, the revisor of statutes, Legislative Affairs Agency. This is Program Receipts 3. Program Receipts 1 was enacted in 1986 as a result of a long-standing discussion between the House Finance Committee and OMB about the treatment of program receipts in the budget. And they wanted to get a little better handle on all the miscellaneous income of state government beyond basic taxation and what it was going to support. In 1990, we finally passed Program Receipts 2, which was sort of a follow-up on that. Primarily, that was designed to make more specific and express program receipt authority in various agencies, many of which, most of whom actually, had been charging but didn't have express authority to do so. It also, in this committee in 1989, when I first heard that bill, introduced the concept of central provision that would cover all the basic boilerplate involved in program receipt accounting and eliminate all of the dozens of little repetitive statements that were cropping up throughout the statutes about the Commissioner of Administration separately accounting the legislature having the right to make appropriations to XYZ based on the estimated balance in that account. It's not that we were getting tired of writing it, but it was one of those things when you start being that specific and that decentralized, if you will, it's very easy to forget something or miss something or not have it all right. It's much easier to have a central system and then draft exceptions to that when it's appropriate, but otherwise you've got general law that covers the situation. Program Receipts 3 is just sort of the finishing stroke. This is cleaning up all of the existing program receipts language that was made redundant or unnecessary as a result of Program Receipts 2. There's nothing new in here. It is all existing law that's either being deleted in most cases or repealed in many, many cases. A few situations which are unique, existing language is just modified slightly to fit the existing situation into the general provisions. It was felt by the House Finance Committee that when this bill came through, it should be limited to a specific technical bill. Nothing new should come into it. We should clean up the books. If OMB or some legislator or anybody else wants to try for some new program receipts authority, that's something for another piece of legislation. Let's end the basic program receipts work once and for all with this cleanup bill and be done with it, and then you can look at new things in isolation. That's basically the story behind it. I'll be happy to answer any questions about it.
This isn't the bill that came before Lake Council, it was a different revisor.
That was the revisor's bill. This is sort of a special revisor's bill. This is done at the request of last year's State Affairs Committee and House Finance Committee, and also the Senate Rules Committee, which Senate Finance looked at it, but didn't do a lot of Arliss and Rule during the interim took a hard look at it, and she bought onto this concept of, let's not try to do this in that bill because it was already long. Let's keep that one as short as we can, at least not make it any longer, and just come through and clean up first thing this session, and that's what this is doing. I didn't want to put it into the regular revisor's bill because this kind of thing sometimes scares people. We're dealing with money, with fees, government charges for services, and people are spooked enough by the revisor's bill, perhaps having something hidden in it, and I just didn't want to marry those two. So this is a separate bill that House Finance requested.
And has House Finance, have they actually seen this bill already and so kind of given their blessing to it?
Several members have, yes. They saw it to introduce it. The one member of House Finance who was very familiar with it, Kay Brown, the one remaining member who really worked on it before, was the one that carried it before the committee, but before the committee, and was looked at it by all the members. And they'll look at it again after this committee's meeting. It was referred to this committee because State Affairs was involved in the process last year and the year before.
Mr. Chairman, what kinds of exceptions would be appropriate? You mentioned some may not follow this boilerplate language. Do you have an example?
Sure. The one that I mentioned in my memo and the one that I always can remember is the additional tax on cigarettes. Now, normally a tax, a specialized tax like that, goes to collection fees and perhaps some related kind of program. What kind of programs related to cigarettes? Lots of them, perhaps. Fire prevention, maybe? Yeah. Health care. Well, the legislature specifically wants that little bit of additional money, the increment, to go to health services. So that's something that should be mentioned. But it's rational, but it's not necessarily logical. It's not like state park fees going to help the state park program. So that's where you need to have some language that says this is clearly where that money goes. Otherwise, it goes back to the source, essentially, the program that generated the fee. There aren't really very many of those, but there are enough that you have to have that provision. And there's a few in here you'll see that are like that. Interest earnings on a fund may not go back to that fund necessarily. They almost always do.
I have to be the first to admit that I'm not familiar with this particular piece of legislation. I'm sure the chairman is well briefed.
Well,
the intricacies and details of Section AS 45.55.030B. But, I am familiar with legislation such as this that sometimes gets committees such as this in deep trouble because it's far-reaching and has a high degree of impact on the fiscal policy of this state. I'm positive that what we may be considering here is what we should be doing, but I also have a nagging feeling in my stomach that there's so much here that I'm a little reluctant to act with a significant amount of haste without really looking at 47.050.55C. And I don't know, Mr. Chairman, what do you think?
I wonder if we could get Representative Brown down here.
pages long.
Her staff is here.
Eric, would you take table with us, please? So why don't you stay with us, Dave? Just Eric will find a chair there.
Next best thing.
We're not on.
Okay. Eric, just
state
Chairman,
your name.
For the record, my name is Eric Myers. I work for Representative Kay Brown. As background, I did work with Mr. Dierdorf last year on HB 85, which was the program receipts bill that he alluded to earlier. I have to say I have not this year studied this particular measure in detail. John Lindback from Representative Brown's staff has been working on it. He and Representative Brown are both in a budget subcommittee meeting at this time, which is why they're not here. I appreciate the comments of Representative Baker. The program receipts bill is truly one of the more intimidating pieces of legislation that I've been familiar with, and it's been sort of a flying Dutchman of the legislature the last 6 years, or at least the last 4 years. I think that I can say on behalf of Representative Brown that the measure before you is truly a housekeeping measure intended to try and put to bed some of the drafting technicalities that are residual from prior efforts, that there are no substantive policy changes reflected in this measure, and that this is truly a technical measure rather than anything that breaks new grounds in terms of establishing the authorities or redirecting fees from in a way that deviates from what was adopted by the legislature last year. As you can see, a lot of it really amounts to just taking out redundant language. That's the lion's share of the bill, is the elimination of this repetitive phraseology. Beyond that, I don't think that I have any much more light to shed on the subject, except that I can say with confidence that that Representative Brown views this as truly a technical measure and not a substantive policy matter.
I think the thing that's scariest always have been with the revisers' bill is repealers. And that a few years ago we started with the revisers' bill with the minimum starting to stand out the text of everything for repealing. And that seems to allay some of the anxiety. So one thing that the bulk of that memo is the text of repealed provisions. And you can see that it's just the same sort of thing, that money collected under this program can be going back to this program. And that's exactly what's covered by the general provision now. We don't really need to test. That's really it in a nutshell. And the reason that the title was deliberately constructed so that unless it was changed, of course, it would be limited to technical things, and so that new substantive provisions couldn't get into it. That was done with malice aforethought. We wanted to keep this exactly what it was supposed to be, and that was a cleanup measure.
Mr. Chairman, I can attest that I had considered a program receipt measure and saw this bill and asked about amending it, and I was told, forget about it. This is strictly technical.
Well, certainly a lot of what's in here is real repeats itself there a lot. is there a companion bill in the Senate?
No.
So this will be the bill, go all the way through. I think I feel most uncomfortable about this bill because of exactly what Representative Baker also said. I feel on one hand that we should send the bill on to the Finance Committee and allow the Finance Committee, who has the technical expertise, to deal with it. On the other hand, I've said that about the Judiciary Committee also before, and I don't want the committee to become a place where, well, just send it through State Affairs and they'll send it on to somebody who knows what they're talking about.
historical comment.
Mr. Dudo.
In the last session, last legislature, in the first session, when this committee got House Bill 85 as the committee of first referral, there was a subcommittee which really poured into the whole subject, and that's where the policy judgment was made about going to a centralized system of law to deal with program seats. They were looking at three different potential CSs, and Jay Hogan, who was the fiscal man who knows the most about program receipts that's still around, and I spent a lot of time with this committee 2 years ago developing that policy approach and then all the technical stuff that went around it. So at least on program receipts, this committee has, as far as staff is concerned anyway, a good reputation of having done an exceptional job last year and really getting into it. It made everybody else's job a lot easier once they made that big policy judgment. And the rest of the legislature went along with that. So, say this, if this had policy in it, I would reinforce your concern, but since that judgment was made last year, this isn't a bill I think we'd be criticized for not spending the next 3 months on it.
Let me say that with no other questions from the committee, my intent then will be to hold this bill over until the next hearing for me to confer with members of the Finance Committee. I'd request the people of this committee look the bill over, or have your staff look it over and see if there's anything that you come up with that was a real problem. If we don't, then my intention will be on Friday to then move the bill on to the House Finance. If someone in the committee or myself does come up with any problems, we'll certainly let you know beforehand so that we can address it then again. Would that be acceptable to the committee? Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, the suggestion I might have is that Senator Strigulski or someone that was eminently involved in this last year might want to come before the committee and give us a little background perspective. I just have an uneasiness like you do. I think we probably haven't been around the horn long enough to recognize what we can shoot ourselves in the foot with sometimes gets dangerous.
I'll also touch base with the senator. Has she seen this bill, then, also, did
it? I don't believe she has, unless she looked at it when it came through.
Okay.
I haven't talked to her staff this year about it.
I would say that the speaker has asked me to hear this bill early and to get this bill moving so that these changes, and he also indicated that he felt the bill was technical in nature and had no substantive policy changes in it. So, all right, thank you very much. I appreciate it. The next bill we're going to deal with is House Bill 129, an act establishing the Public Offices Compensation Commission relating to the compensation of the governor, lieutenant governor, members of the legislature, heads of the principal departments of the executive branch of government, Supreme Court justices, judges, and the Court of Appeals, judges of Superior Court, and District Court judges, and providing for effective date. House Bill 129 is sponsored by the House Rules Committee by the request of the Alaska Supreme Court. If passed, House Bill 129 would create a commission in the office of the governor to determine appropriate compensation for public officials. House Bill 129 may impact House Bill 4, the legislative ethic bills. So it's my intent for the committee to become familiar with House Bill 129. We scheduled 129 for an additional hearing on Monday, February 25th. Chris Christensen is with us this morning, representing Alaska Supreme Court. I'd like Ms. Christensen to join the committee at the table, please, and give us an overview. Good morning, Chris. Overview.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Chris Christensen. I'm the staff counsel to the Alaska court system.
Excuse me, Chris. Thank you. This Representative Finkelstein, if you'd like to find a chair somewhere here, and there's one right behind Chris, maybe pull up to the table. Also, Representative Finkelstein is the prime sponsor of House Bill 4, and really my intent would be to deal with these two bills together if it looks like that's a possibility. Excuse me, Chris, go ahead.
Sure. I'll try to keep my remarks brief, but I'm not always successful. As you noted, Mr. Chairman, HB 129 was introduced at the request of the Supreme Court. The bill creates a public officer's compensation commission with the authority to set the salaries of the governor, lieutenant governor, legislators, commissioners, and justices and judges of the court system. As the members know, since 1986, Alaska has had a state officer's compensation commission, which makes recommendations to the legislature on the compensation levels of those officers. Alaska is one of approximately 27 jurisdictions, including the federal government, that operates a compensation commission of some sort. The purpose behind the creation of these commissions is uniform from state to state. It is to make fair decisions about the compensation of high-ranking government officials. It's believed by many that placing decisions in the hands of an independent commission makes it more likely that compensation adjustments will be dictated purely by the merits rather than by the political circumstances that face the legislature in any given year. Unfortunately, the purely advisory nature of the existing commission has prevented it from accomplishing this goal. Since 1986, the political problems surrounding the determination of appropriate levels of salary, per diem, and allowances for public officials have pretty much continued unabated. The Supreme Court believes that HB 129 would alleviate this problem. In proposing this solution, the court's primary concern, of course, is to attract and retain highly qualified jurists. This requires salaries that are commensurate with the qualifications and responsibilities of the office. Last session, the legislature approved the first pay raise for judges in 5 years. During the 18 months preceding that pay raise, the judiciary lost over 20% of its members, most of them leaving because their salaries had eroded so much and were no longer competitive with what the average makes in the state. I think that this argument about attracting and retaining highly qualified public servants is equally applicable to legislators and to officials in the executive branch. I'd like to go through the bill briefly, just hitting the major points so the members are aware of what it contains. Sections 1 through 5 simply change statutes currently on the books that say that the salaries of the various types of judges will be set by law. It changes that to say that the salaries will be set by the Public Officers Compensation Commission. Sections 6 through 8 make the same sorts of changes to the salary laws for legislators. Section 6 says that the salary for legislators will be established by the commission. Section 7 provides that additional allowances may be authorized. This says may. If the committee wanted allowances, it could change that may to shall. Section 8 says that per diem and additional allowances may be authorized also. Again, that could be changed to shall. In looking at the bill this morning, I did notice one oversight by when this draft was prepared by legal services. AS 2410-105, which is the statute that currently relates to legislative per diem, was not placed in here and amended. I think it would need to be. Compensation is defined as salary, per diem, and allowances. The bill intends giving the commission the power to set per diem, but through an oversight, that section was not placed in here.
That was in the original draft, though, wasn't it?
I believe it was.
I think it was also here. What was that number again?
2410-105. Sure. Sections 9, 10, and 11 simply make the same kinds of changes to the salaries relating to the statutes related to the salaries of the governor and lieutenant governor. Section 12 makes the same sort of change to the law providing for compensation of commissioners. The meat of the bill starts at section 13 on page 3. AS 3923-200, which is the existing State Officers Compensation Commission, is repealed, and this new compensation commission is set up in its place. It has 7 members appointed by the governor. The current commission says that these members must be confirmed by the legislature. The bill that we have prepared does not say that because based on our understanding of the law, this sort of commission, the legislature does not have the authority to confirm members of this sort of commission. I know this is an important issue facing the legislature right now, and this committee may decide that they do wish to have that sort of confirmation. I would note that when the original State Officers Compensation Commission was passed back in 1986, the Attorney General sent a letter to the governor saying that the part of the bill which provided for legislative confirmation was unconstitutional, but since it was a purely advisory commission, it really didn't matter and the governor should sign the bill anyway. This is no longer purely advisory, so if that confirmation provision were placed back in here, presumably the AG would recommend a veto.
Can you explain to me a little bit more why this particular one would be unconstitutional for us to confirm?
My understanding, Mr. Chairman, is that the Constitution has been interpreted to say that the legislature is limited to confirming executive branch officers only when those officers are commissioners or heads or members of commissions that head principal departments. In other cases, the legislature doesn't have the power of confirmation. And this body is not the head of a principal department. I realize that there are many people in the legislature right now who disagree with that interpretation, and I know there are committees that have received testimony disputing that, and that's a matter for the committee's judgment.
So somebody like a board of regents or school board would be considered actually heading a department under the Constitution?
I believe so. I'm not familiar specifically with those.
Okay.
That's my understanding. The current law provides that of the 7 members on the commission, one should have experience in public administration, one in organized labor, one member of a nonpartisan voters organization, and one a business executive. The bill as presented to you would change that. It would have one person with experience in public administration, one with experience in personnel management, one economist, and one attorney. Choosing people from different professions is purely arbitrary. The committee certainly can add or delete whatever types of professions it think would be able to provide the commission with the kind of experience it really needed to do its job. The commission meets every other year at the call of the chair, which is required to hold public hearings. Basically, the commission is set up and has the same sorts of responsibilities that the current commission has. One other difference between the current commission and the proposed commission is that the current commission has staff provided by Legislative Affairs Agency. Again, in the letter which the Department of Law sent to the governor when he was considering signing the bill that created the current commission, it was pointed out that having the Legislative Affairs Agency provide staff to an executive branch might, or an executive commission might violate the separation of powers. So we have moved this from LIA to the Department of Administration. Again, that's a judgment call for this committee to make. The fact that it's in the Department of Administration now rather than LAA might affect the fiscal note. That, I think, be the only significance of that. The duties of the commission are in Section 15. The commission is required to review the compensation of the governor, lieutenant governor, legislators, commissioners, and judges, and it shall submit a report of its findings every odd-numbered year during the first 10 days of the legislature. Of course, the odd-numbered years are years in which there are not elections. Again, we're trying to remove this from the partisan process. The commission does not have to, but it may submit an order changing compensation if it determines that changes to compensation are warranted. It has to give public notice of its preliminary findings, solicit public comments, and give due regard to the public comments before it issues an order. An order making changes to compensation becomes effective 60 days after submission or at the end of the legislative session, whichever is earliest, unless the legislature passes a bill which is signed by the governor disapproving the order. I would note that one legislature can't bind another. The practical effect of that is that even though the bill indicates that the legislature has only a 60-day period to affect compensation orders, the legislature would still have it within its authority to pass a law after that 60-day period changing compensation if it wanted to. The only way to take that power away would be by constitutional amendment. So we do have a 60-day window, but the power of the legislature is not completely limited after that 60 days. Section 17 relates to the policy of the legislature. In giving the commission the power to actually set salaries, the legislature is delegating a fairly significant legislative power to this agency. Of course, the legislature delegates its power to agencies all the time. We have the administrative code probably somewhere in this office that's about 2.5 feet thick, which represents not all but part of the regulations that have been adopted pursuant to legislative delegations of power. In order for a legislative delegation of power to be constitutional, there has to be some sort of guidelines which let the agency know how it's supposed to conduct itself. The guidelines we've set out are listed on page 5. These guidelines are guidelines that the current commission, my understanding is, does consider even though they're not spelled out. Of course, the current commission powers are advisory, not real, so these do not need to be set out in the current law. They do need to be set out here, however. We have based these factors on the factors which are contained in the Compensation Commission statute in Illinois. That's a commission very similar to this one, and it has been upheld in the Illinois courts. We've modified these factors a bit to take into account Alaska considerations, things like the geographic cost of living differential. And then finally, in the definition section, you see the compensation and salary, per diem, and allowances. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions that the members might have about how this works and what problems there might be. And I would note, just for the record, that in the past, it's always been assumed that in order to create a compensation commission that had the power to actually set salaries, this needed to be done by constitutional amendment. I've done a good deal of research, and this has just seemed to be common knowledge. No one's actually ever researched the issue before. It was never really considered or discussed when previous committees debated the existing compensation commission. Legislative Affairs never wrote an opinion to that effect. The AG never wrote an opinion to that effect. People just assumed it. The Supreme Court has had some research done and has considered the issue. Of course, they're acting administratively, not as a judicial body. They weren't wearing up black robes. And in their judgment, this is the sort of the powers that are being given to this commission can be delegated by the legislature legislatively. They do not need to be delegated with a constitutional amendment.
I assume that your main concern is with the judicial system in here, and that any way we would add or subtract from the other people in there really is not your concern.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Our concern is judges. We'd be happy to give you guidance as to what we think would be a constitutional way to do this, but which public officers are covered is something purely within the discretion of this committee.
Personally, I happen to like this form. I think it would take a lot of the politics out. Also, I personally would rather remove the department heads. I believe they're a completely different category of people than the judges and the elected people. And they really should not have that political stigma attached to them as elected people do. And so I think I will be proposing an amendment to remove them from this bill. One thing I had on my members committee, representative which one do I call her? Choquette.
He had a sentence.
Mr. Chairman, the section 2410-110, additional allowances, that is currently dealt with by a committee of both houses. Is that correct? Larry, you're on that committee? As far as per diem or postage. And would then do away with that committee that's currently functioning?
Yes. In my understanding, legislative council would no longer
exist if this becomes law.
It would exist, but it wouldn't deal with that because this would become a matter of statute.
Through the chair, Representative Chuck, had that be my understanding? This commission would be responsible for setting those.
Chairman, if I could, one more question.
Continue, Representative Chuck.
The means by which this commission would determine compensation, you've got 12 of them down here. You stated that this was researched in terms of Illinois. California?
Through the chair, Representative Choquette, these are factors which we've modified a little bit, but this is the laundry list in the Illinois statute.
Mm-hmm.
There are the 26 jurisdictions that have 27 jurisdictions that have compensation commissions. Nine of them actually have the authority to set salary levels as opposed to merely recommending them. And of those nine, seven do it by provisions in the state constitution, two do it by law. One is Delaware, the other is Illinois. The Delaware system has never been considered by the Delaware courts. The Illinois has. The Illinois cases relied very heavily on a series of federal cases which upheld the similar federal salary compensation commission. And we believe this laundry list sets an appropriate standard, a standard that is constitutional if the commission would follow it in terms of exercising delegated powers.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I might, one more. I believe we need to have the heads of departments involved in this. I think that some of the same circumstances that cause people not to run for the legislature or judges not to become judges exist with the department heads.
Just for the record, sir.
Thank you. That's all I have.
Representative Bruckman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your comments about the department chair because I had some concern in that area too and tend to agree with you. My main concern was though that the power of the governor to appoint the members of this commission. There's a separation of powers. We have the three branches and I would think that they should all be involved, or at least the legislature involved in the appointment. So that's my main concern. In it, and I would like to hear from Representative Finkelstein and how it affects the ethics bill. And, I'm supportive of the concept of the commission. I think it would take politics out of setting salaries. I know in the municipality of Anchorage, the Salaries and Emoluments Commission has that power and has worked quite well in setting unfair salaries for like the people. So I thank you.
One thing you might think of when you say the governor appoints people and the more the legislature is not involved, probably the less heat they take for anybody to get the pay raise. So.
Oh, exactly. But nonetheless, to have all the power and the appointment of commissioners from one person, when it affects so drastically three branches of government, is overpowering. I have some real concerns.
Well, in that other respect, we also obviously have our input. We can stop at any time. As a matter of fact, could we not pass a law and change those salaries at any time we wanted to? So really, we're not being...
But, Mr. Chair, would the governor have veto over the legislative act of changing the salaries?
Sure.
So we would then...
In fact, that's one of the governor's... at least the AG's concerns that we have here is that the governor in this situation does not have veto power.
Does not?
No, we would. We have veto power
right.
As a legislature. The governor does not because there'll be no law actually passed doing it. This will become automatic. And that's one of the governor's objections. Is there a way to get around that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, as I noted before, the legislature can constitutionally delegate its power to make law. And any time it does that, it takes the governor out of the loop. The governor loses his power to veto that law. And as we do have that kind of clause, all of which were passed without the governor having the opportunity to veto them. As I understand the issue that was raised by the Department of Law, it was that since the Constitution says that salaries must be set by law, this creates a different kind of delegation problem. That since the Constitution says by law, that means it actually has to be done by law, and the power can't be delegated. I'm unaware of any cases in this or other states that say that the term by law, prescribed by law, ascertained by law in a constitution does limit the legislature's ability to delegate. We do have one case in this state, I believe it's Warren v. Boucher. It's about a 15-year-old case in which the legislature had a duty that was, the Constitution said something that must be prescribed by law, and the court upheld the ability of the legislature to delegate that power to the lieutenant governor. I believe it was the ability to determine whether or not initiative was the same as a law that was passed by the legislature. There are cases in the federal system and in Illinois in which the courts have specifically held that the term by law in the Constitution does not limit the ability of the legislature or the Congress to delegate that power to an agency. The delegation ability might be slightly different, it might be slightly tighter. You might have to comply with more rules, but you still have the authority to delegate. The purpose of when the term by law is placed in a constitution, and by the way, the Constitution says that by law means by the legislature, merely is to establish accountability, who's responsible. And as long as the accountability is, the courts have held that as long as accountability is maintained, then the legislature is doing something by law, even if they've delegated the power. In the specific cases that have considered this issue relating to compensation commissions in other jurisdictions, it has been fairly uniformly held that as long as the legislature or the Congress retains the power of appropriation, which they would still have here, as long as there is a layover period in which the legislature or the Congress can consider the matter before it becomes effective, which we have here, as long as the Congress or the legislature can pass overriding legislation at some future point in time, then the by-law term in the Constitution would be met.
Could another section be added that says that this becomes the salaries, this becomes a law, in essence, unless the legislature turns it down in 60 days, or unless the governor, can we give the governor a veto power over it also, without actually having a law?
I'd have to give that some thought, Mr. Chairman. That's something I hadn't considered.
Do that for me.
Sure.
I guess I'm looking at a way, if we go with this route, can you pass it? And are we talking about the governor vetoing this bill just because he is out of the loop? Maybe that's not. Representative Moyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Christensen partially answered my question, and I'm sort of thinking on the same lines as yourself. But I guess you can look at it as the executive branch's opportunity to influence the outcome is by who they appoint, since there is no veto. The legislature, because we can't make appointments to an executive branch commission, can't influence it that way, but we can influence it by disapproving it. I'll leave the court's role unasked, because it doesn't occur to me any way the courts can influence it. In my way of reading it, I'll leave that question unasked, but it brings up another question that has been dealt with by many other committees, and that is the cause for removal of commission members. I didn't see it in the bill. I don't know if it's in the existing or the old commission, but perhaps Mr. Christensen could address that. And we have another question after that.
Mr. Chairman, I am not an expert on that area of the law. I assume that the cause for removal would be the same as it was for other commissions of this type. Again, I'm not particularly familiar for that. My understanding is that it's that the position of the governor is that it's at the discretion of the governor.
It's not, Mr. Chairman, spoke to it, as I read in any way here explicitly. I think we ought to consider whether it should be, and of course, what it should say, pending the outcome of the other other question in regards...
Or serves at the pleasure. I mean, that's really a policy question as to which way we want to deal with that.
My other question regards section 3923250, page 4, line 21, whereupon the commission shall transfer its order to the lieutenant governor. And we do know that lieutenant governors have exercised different levels of authority, for example, in regulations. And in any way, could this be an opportunity for the lieutenant governor to say, no, I refuse to accept the order because, or in any way, give him authority that we maybe didn't intend to, given the way that some of the lieutenant governors have operated with regulations recently?
Through the chair, Representative Moyer, my understanding would be that that the lieutenant governor's powers here would be purely ministerial in nature, and that he would not have the ability to reject an order or refuse to file an order. The order merely needs to be filed in the office of the lieutenant governor, and it, the law says it automatically becomes effective. I believe the term is, let's see, 60 days after submission to the legislature. So I don't believe that the lieutenant governor would have any ability to affect it.
Could you get Lieutenant Coggle to say that, please?
Representative Finkelstein, how would this, what would your thoughts be if this bill was adopted by the committee and sent along basically in place of what is in the present proposal on the ethics bill as far as compensation goes?
Well, I think it's a great approach, and I really appreciate the fact that Core Systems made the effort.
I believe what I'll be doing is having some work sessions on this bill as well as House Bill 4 sort of together. People have specific recommendations on changes. I have down the, let's see, you had one that we had to add in there on the per diem, talking about a couple others. I think what I'd like to do is set up a work session maybe for the committee or a subcommittee of the whole, as many of you that want to be involved as possible, to try to work this in and look at it with the ethics bill too, and see how we can come up with something. I'd like to move this bill, but I'd like to move it with the ethics bill. One other thing, what would you think of a clause in here that, along with this recommendation, that the present recommendations of the commission become enacted also with the passage of this bill? In other words, we have a commission now that is purely advisory.
Mr. Chairman, I need to make sure I understand what you're saying. We do have a report that the commission gave the legislature in 1989 making a number of recommendations.
Yeah.
I guess my comment would be that the legislature was generous enough last year to enact most of the recommendations of the commission with respect to judges. So our concerns have pretty much already been taken care of. If the legislature wished to enact the rest of the recommendations, certainly your prerogative, and the court takes no position on it.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Shulkin.
I'd just like to ask Representative Finkelstein a question. What do you think about moving this bill along with the ethics bill? I have a tendency to think that it should stay on its own. I think we can make the changes in the ethics bill, as Representative Finkelstein has suggested, which deal with compensation. But I don't know as though leaving or tacking the two together at this time might be the best procedure.
Well, the only thing I would say is I plan on moving these bills out of here together. What some other committee does down the road is they're not tied together. They'll be separate votes. But I'd like to move them both.
Did you have any comments on that?
Well, there is the reason the pay raise was in the ethics bill was because it's an integral part of ethics reform. I mean, I don't know if people follow at all what's going on in the state of Arizona, but there's something like 10 state legislators under indictment there, and I don't really know what the pay range there is, but it's probably in the order of $20,000 a year. You end up with too many people with their hands out, and you know, both the recommendations of the existing commission, the report from the Senate consultant Michael Josephson, and you know, most of our own personal feelings indicate that a pay raise is warranted. The there's a political problem with it. There's a perception that it's their own doing, and I still think it's an issue tied to the ethics bill. I believe it's really important ethical reform to have a new system for compensation. I think this is a better system, but you know, like Representative Venus said, what you know, future committees do is you know, beyond our control. So.
Other comments? All right, we will be taking up this in some subcommittee work, and whatever we end up with, we'll make sure we get to you and get your comments before we bring it back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
What I'd like to do now is set this one aside also. Take out, to deal with House Bill 4, we've already had our initial hearing on House Bill 4. House Bill 4 is the ethics bill. I'd like to hear from the Alaska Public Offices Commission, if we could, on the ethics bill. State your name and for the record.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Karen Dorman, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Public Offices Commission. I have to apologize to the committee. I had hoped that you would have a copy of the Commission's position paper and fiscal note, but under the new procedure, those are being released by the Department of Administration and not the Commission directly, and they have not been released yet. I expect that you will have them shortly. So with that in mind, these comments are solely on behalf of the Commission. The Commission has reviewed House Bill 4, which would establish a Legislative Ethics Commission and standards of conduct for legislators, and it believes that this legislation is in the public interest and supports its enactment. The Commission does have several questions and concerns, however. In Section 2461.160, which deals with restrictive relationships of lobbyists, legislators, legislative candidates, and legislative assistants. I'm sorry, page 5. The way that this is structured, the responsibility for regulating legislators, legislative candidates, and legislative assistants falls to the Legislative Ethics Commission, and the responsibility for regulating lobbyists falls to the Alaska Public Office Commission. This is a very workable assignment of responsibility consistent with current responsibilities. The Commission, however, does anticipate that complaints will arise from lobbyist activity, and current law only allows for criminal penalties unless there is some reporting violation. And the activities we're talking about here are behavioral rather than reporting violations. The Commission would ask that you consider the addition of civil penalties as a more cost-effective way of method of penalty for potential violations. The second section I'd like to speak to is Article 3, which is on page 13. This is the campaign finance restriction. Currently, the way this is worded, it applies only to legislators and legislative candidates. The commission would ask that you consider that this should also apply to candidates for governor, lieutenant governor, and local office as well. This is with the exception of the section that deals with fundraising limitations on legislators during legislative session.
Is that a conflict? I mean, just in the title, that seems to be a conflict. For example,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, it's we faced the same thing last year, and the way because there is a problem with single subject within the bill. The bill only covers legislators in a variety of areas. Doesn't cover other candidates in the state. But the point is completely true, and the solution is to have a companion bill, which I've submitted to the commission for their review, which accompanies the ethics bill and applies its campaign financing provisions to other races in the state. That was the same approach we took last year. Senator Pershow had a companion bill that followed behind the ethics bill, and it too died in the final hours. But the point is a very good one, that the standards we set for these kind of basic campaign financing restrictions should be universal, including even local races, as far as I'm concerned. You know, basically all races. If they're a good idea here, they ought to be there. And I will submit that bill, and it'll come before the committee.
Representative Chocette.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Finkelstein, on that section where you start a candidate for the legislature, can't you just stop that as a candidate for public office and include it be all inclusive?
Mr. Chairman, the problem with it is just a single subject. You could do it in terms of the grammar of the bill, you're right. The problem is you have a bill then that's covering legislators and the legislative arena in a variety of areas, plus candidates, and the legislative attorneys have interpreted that it's no longer a single subject, it's now two subjects.
Yep. That's all I have, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, also in that section, the prohibited uses of campaign funds, this is also on page 13, the commission had a couple of concerns. First of all, we believe that a definition of personal benefit will be needed, either by statute or regulation. The commission's preference would be, if you are comfortable with that, that it be by statute, but they would pursue a regulation to define that. The reason for that is that personal benefit has had a variety of meanings in the past, and the uses that campaign funds are put to cover a wide gamut. Also, the commission is concerned that currently shared campaign expenses can happen. That is, two candidates for office can share the cost of an airplane to go speak to a remote area. And the commission is concerned that not be made illegal in the current order, that be continued to be allowed. Also, that the return of excessive or illegal contributions be allowed, that this wording not be construed to prohibit that. And one point that the commission would like clarification on is in the case where a candidate did not know of the actions of the member of the campaign and that action resulted in a penalty, may campaign funds be used to pay the fine in that case? Is that the intent? The next section I'd like to address is 2461.310, disbursement of surplus campaign funds on page 14. The commission has suggested wording, which we will provide to you, that would allow for one report, the year-end report, to disclose disbursement of surplus campaign funds. Currently, the wording could be construed that an extra report would be necessary, and we would like to to try to avoid that.
What number is that?
This is disbursement of surplus campaign funds 2461.3. And this would just be wording to change the 60 days or the end of the year. And that would alter that to have the reporting cycle run together to be the 1 year end report that is currently required. Also, as proposed, this section would not be implemented until after the next election in 1992 or later for those not running in 1992. Time limitations on fundraising, section 2461.320. The commission raised a concern about the definition of public official. Public official is defined as a person required to file campaign disclosure statements. Currently, some elected public officials do not have to file campaign disclosure statements if their communities are under 1,000 in population or if their voters have exempted them from filing. So the inclusion of other incumbent elected public officials on line 5, since that also ties in with the definition of public officials, could present a problem, since they do not all have to file campaign disclosure statements.
But it says intending to run for the legislature.
Correct. So, for example, a municipal official who was intending to run for the legislature in his current position could conceivably not have to file campaign disclosure statements. Because his community was under 1,000 population, so he might not fall under this definition. That was the concern. Also, in subsection 2, the commission would request the candidate should be followed by including unsuccessful candidates to ensure that post-election fundraising is not conducted by those who no longer feel that they are candidates. The next section, section 2461.330, enforcement of campaign fund provisions. The way this is structured creates overlapping authority between the APOC and the LEC in the enforcement of campaign fund provisions. The commission felt this was inefficient and unworkable, and that the commission should continue to have primary responsibility, full responsibility for administering campaign finance provisions, both for efficiency and to avoid confusion among filers and the public. Also, enforcement of criminal penalties is expensive and time-consuming, and current law allows for civil penalties only when there are reporting violations. So again, the commission would ask that you give consideration to instituting civil penalties in this section for APOC to administer rather than the LEC as it's currently proposed. The next section that affects the commission is Article 5, required disclosure on page 16. The way this is structured, the Alaska Public Offices Commission would no longer apply the conflict of interest law to legislators and legislative candidates. But legislators and legislative candidates would fall under these disclosure requirements, and that would be administered by the LEC. The governor and lieutenant governor would continue to fall under APOC statutes. It's the commission's position that, again, candidates for governor and lieutenant governor should file at the same standard of disclosure as legislative candidates. And the commission is concerned primarily that there will be confusion among filers and the public as to what is filed, what has to be filed, who has to file it, where they can go to look at it, what will be public, what will not be public. And the suggestion that the commission has is, number one, this will require a fair amount of coordination among the Division of Election, the commission, and the LEC, but also a set of reports, required reports, under this law should be made available at APOC offices, and in that way the public can go to one place and review them, and that will eliminate some of the confusion. I will speak generally. We feel there is a fiscal impact from this legislation, and at the moment, since you do not have the fiscal need, I will just speak generally. But we believe we would need additional staff for investigation purposes, and in the first year, to prepare regulations. The commission would need to hold a hearing to adopt regulations to institute these sections of the law. There would be training and printing expenses, and that would be primarily it. We would also need some clerical support. And then over the long term, there would need to be funds allocated to allow for hearings under the complaint procedure and the Administrative Procedures Act. And we're estimating that there could conceivably be one complaint a year, but not in the first year, that would be in subsequent years. That concludes my comments. I'd be happy to try and answer any questions, and I'd be happy to work with the committee as you begin your work session.
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chairman, Karen, then I guess just from what you described on the fiscal note size, it's probably it's $150,000, $200,000.
It's not quite that high.
Representative Choquette.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Karen, what fiscal note do we have here? I have
$147,000.
That's an LAA one. Yeah. She's talking about a EPOC fiscal note.
Well, this is the commission's members, executive director. Mm-hmm.
Representative Moyer.
My question isn't directly on the bill, and I'd be glad to hold it if there are others on the bill. Not Karen, it's regarding your statement in the beginning of your testimony that the commissioner now prepares the fiscal note for the commission. And I was wondering for the reason behind that, and if you feel that the fiscal notes will be to your satisfaction, even though you won't be signing them.
Mr. Chairman, I may have misspoken. The commissioner does not prepare them. The commission still prepares and signs them. The current procedure set up is that all position papers and fiscal notes go through, in our case, the Department of Administration, since that's where the budget and responsibility lies for us. And this is the first one of any substance, and at this point, I don't know how that procedure is going to work. I assume that the problem here was just a time problem and not an issue.
If I may continue, I suppose we'll find out as it goes along, but if there is some problem by the commissioner during that review, there must be some conflict resolution process set out, I would hope. I guess they're going to be playing this one by ear for a while.
At this point, Mr. Chairman, I don't know what that process is, but I'm assuming that everything is on schedule. It's just a question of time.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
The way you did it before, this previous to this administration, you would just submit them yourself?
That's correct. The commission would submit directly to committee.
But under statute, you are under the Department of Administration.
Well, the commission is a quasi-judicial, semi-autonomous body. we are under the Department of Administration by statute, and when it comes to questions of budgeting and correct procedures of accounting and personnel, we fall under the Department of Administration's guidance.
Other questions? I assume we're going to get a written statement from you also outlining these things again.
As I said, I hope you would have that today.
Is that the reason that it's not here? Is that also has
That's
to go
correct.
Through the
That's correct.
Commissioner?
But these are prepared and approved and signed by the commission.
Well, I don't want to speculate where we go here. If you have problems in that area, I'll just, when you do have them available to distribute, I'd appreciate them as soon as possible. Yes. Representative Finkelstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to say I think the points you made are very good ones. Some of them were the original intent of the bill. It just wasn't well enough explained in the bill. Other ones were changed, I think.
there's only a couple where the problem is the one subject rule, the expanding it to the non-incumbent legislative candidates, for instance, that particular area. But I think I just really appreciate the effort you made going through the bill. So.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you for the opportunity.
You betcha. We'll be in touch. We do have session shortly with, is Vicki Borrego here? Vicki, did you have something prepared that you would like to address on this bill at this point?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if you do have time, I'd be
How long do you need?
I could leave it as a written testimony, so if you need any shorter time, that would be fine.
You know, if you would do that and maybe just give us a couple-minute overview here of what your position is on the whole bill and if you have major problems with it.
I'd be happy to do that.
Okay.
My name is Vicki Borrego, and I represent the Alaska League of Women Voters. And what I wanted to let you know today is that, in principle, the League is very supportive of HB 4 and has made it our top legislative priority for this session. We, as you may know, worked with the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics to conduct a number of workshops to try to get more in touch with what was concerning the public. And so, in addition to that, there are a series of discussion groups and study groups that are taking place throughout the state related to campaign finance reform. And that will culminate in a revision to our formal position statement that will be given at our state convention in April. So we're going to be watching the progress of this piece of legislation very, very carefully and closely. And I just might mention very quickly, I'll leave my written testimony for the record, that in a recent teleconference that took place among the members of the Juneau, Anchorage, Fairbanks, Ketchikan, and Sitka chapters, just informally, this is not part of the formal position statement as yet, but I would say that membership supports much more stringent campaign finance reform and limitations on campaigning in terms of periods of time between the general primary and the primary itself, and more stringent limitations in terms of financing campaigns in general. So overall, we're in principle very supportive of HB 4, and we'll be watching its progress with great interest. Thanks.
Thank you. Is there any questions from the committee? Thank you, Karen. We're going to leave that with Mary over here.
Certainly,
anyway.
I'd be happy to.
Good. I called you Karen. Cam Stoops, do you want to add anything?
Just would be glad to work with the committee on revising the fiscal notice as they deem appropriate. So.
Okay. All right. What I'd like to do is set up some work time on this bill. Obviously, this is a long bill, mm-hmm. and. I'd like to do it. Let's see, what's today? Wednesday. Can we maybe have some time tomorrow afternoon?
That's a tough one for me.
Tomorrow's a bad day altogether.
We're both on
resources. Yeah. 3 o'clock.
And Labor and Commerce is 1 to 3.
How many want to be involved, let's put it this way, in a subcommittee to do some rewrites on this?
I should be.
I'd like to nominate Max.
Max would be good. Max would like to take my place.
You don't.
I always thought I'd never volunteer for this.
I know, but this isn't the Army. Well, it could be. But thus, we'll set up some time here, at least to get some movement of where we're coming.
I'll sure look at my schedule.
I just don't know what I've got now.
It's Thursday? Friday's Thursday? Friday's Thursday, I mean, it's Saturday?
That's a good idea. How about we do some stuff on Saturday or Sunday?
Afternoon?
David?
That's fine, me too.
You here this weekend?
Yeah, it might be worth still trying if we can get one meeting, just so other members might be able to attend tomorrow or Friday. I'm sure we could find a time on the table.
I'm more open, it's...
You set a time and I'll make my time available.
How about 5:00 tomorrow?
Five o'clock tomorrow.
Wait, right here. And this would be on 4, I mean, both ends.
So we're going to have a work session at 5:00 tomorrow. My intention is also to have them some time over the weekend.
Yeah, yeah.
So people of the committee that are interested, I'd like to do that. They'll ring in. Next meeting, House State Affairs Committee will be Friday, February 22nd. At that time, we'll be taking up HJR 22. This is the first hearing on that relating to opposing of reduction of the federal COLA. We will also very possibly be taking up a committee substitute for House Bill 86, which we heard the other day, and we have one or two committee substitutes that we'll be doing with.
86, you said?
Yeah. There's nothing else. The committee will adjourn at 9:52.